Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is New Books in Science Fiction, and I'm Rob Wolf, author of The Alternate Universe, and usually I'm your solo host. Today, however, I'm joined by Aubrey Fox, who is also a writer as well as an avid reader, and most importantly, I think for today's show, a big fan of science fiction. Hi, Aubrey.
Hi there, Rob.
So Aubrey was on the show with me a while back to interview Dave Hutchinson about his Fractured Europe series. Aubrey, in fact, alerted me to how amazing those books were, and he's actually done it again with today's guest, telling me how amazing she is, and saying I just had to have her on the show. So I asked her, and we're going to have her on the line in a moment. But I thought maybe, Aubrey, why don't you introduce her before we get her on the line?
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, I only come out of podcast retirement for very important events. So this is my second podcast with you.
I like to think all the podcast episodes are important, but I understand.
Well, not all of them have me on it. I mean, that is one important difference.
This is true. And we have amazing chemistry.
Today's author is, her name is E.J. Swift, and she has written a terrific book called Paris Adrift. Which in my mind does a lot of interesting things. And one really interesting thing that it does is it kind of combines two genres. You get two books for the price of one, in a sense. You get an interesting science fiction book about a young woman who is tasked with this time travel challenge that involves essentially saving the world from apocalypse. But at the same time, she is the protagonist in a kind of coming-of-age tale where she's a young woman starting work in this Parisian bar and meeting friends and having this kind of rich cultural and social experience in the kind of universe of this bar.
Yeah, I thought it was a very rich portrait of a young girl and a community that she finds herself in.
Yeah, what I liked is that normally in science fiction books, the characters are kind of a vehicle just for the plot. And in some senses, it felt to me in the richest part of the book that it was the reverse, that there was a kind of plot that was driving the book, but really it was the evocation of these characters and her becoming employed in this bar and meeting people and having all these rich relationships that kind of took over the experience of the book for long stretches. And that's unusual for a science fiction novel. I felt like if the book had just been about her and her experience in Paris and none of the other elements, it would have been worth reading entirely on its own.
Right. It was a good combination. I mean, I find that those are some of the books I enjoy the best that have both excellent, strong, and unique characters and a personal journey and the science fiction elements. So lately I've been naming the episode, so you had a suggestion that we call it Tilting at Windmills.
Green Windmills.
Green Windmills. That, I think, nails it. So this is the Tilting at Green Windmills episode.
And are we going to explain why we're calling it that? Or is that something that's going to be revealed in the interview?
Hopefully it'll be revealed in the interview. And if it isn't,
wow,
people will have to read the book.
We'll be accountable for this.
Yeah, exactly.
So we have to weave this into the interview.
Yeah, hopefully it'll come up naturally.
Okay.
Let's get EJ on the line. E.J. Swift, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So do you prefer EJ or Emma?
I am happy with either, but Emma is fine for today.
Your first books, the Osiris Project Trilogy, they were about climate change. This book is different. It's about a young woman, Haley, who ends up traveling through time. She changes history as she goes. And I was wondering what drew you to this idea and this particular story.
I used to live in Paris for about a year. So I've always had a real love for the city. It's such a beautiful place. And I spent about 18 months living and working there. So I'd always kind of had an idea in the back of my head that one day I would perhaps visit that setting for a novel of some kind. But I think where the idea for the sort of time travel story came from was really my experience of working the night shift in a bar in Montmartre. And there was something incredibly surreal about the experience of kind of ending the shift, coming out into the sort of daylight world, and the rest of the world is kind of waking up and the boulangeries are opening and there's traffic and everyone's kind of suited and going to work on the metro, and you're kind of staggering out at the end of this very long shift, feeling very tired, probably covered in Jägermeister, and you kind of got to get to sleep in this kind of very busy daytime world. And there was something about that experience of everything being turned upside down. And I guess from that, I just kind of thought, what would happen to actually really push that strangeness and, go beyond the kind of day-to-day real life experience of that into something that's really, really a different kind of world altogether. And from that, I just kind of had this really, I think, quite mad idea about putting a time portal in the keg room of a bar and sort of seeing what happened. And that, I guess, that was the kind of inspiration for the idea. And the character kind of just grew out of that, really. I think the character of Hallie just sort of came after the idea of the time travel in a way. But once I had this this sort of thought of this this young woman who was kind of running away from her old life, really wanting to start over and become new, become a new person, and that kind of married with the time travel and this idea that through time traveling, that was a way for her to achieve that. I think that was kind of, in a long-winded way, what I was trying to do.
It's interesting to me that you have this experience, because some of the strongest elements of the book, in my opinion, are how you bring to life the kind of social world of the bar and the relationships that she has, Haley has, with these friends that she meets. And I'm just curious, did you have a similar experience socially? Did you develop relationships when you worked there that, were similarly rich?
I certainly had the experience of meeting people from a lot of different countries from all over the world. And that was something I hugely valued and felt was a real privilege of my time there. The fact that I was able to go and live and work in another country with nothing but my passport and meet all these incredibly interesting people. So certainly that was something I kind of wanted to capture in the novel and to try and just to try and portray a little bit of that lifestyle. And I think there's something also about when you are working in that kind of quite intense environment under quite a lot of pressure. Not in a way that really matters, because ultimately, you're serving drinks to people, but the sort of busyness of it and the kind of sense of trying to get through the night, it can form these quite intense friendships, but also they're very fleeting sometimes, because people come and go so often in a job like that. People come for a few months and they'd leave. I was only there myself for about 18 months, not working in the bar the whole time. So yeah, I think that was something that I really wanted to try and bring to the novel, that quite intense but very meaningful at the same time, those sort of friendships.
I was impressed how much everyone could drink and still, yes, stay on their feet and be awake the next day and even save the world.
Yeah, I could not do that now, that's for sure. Maybe Hallie could, but yeah, that's not something I would be keen to revisit these days.
So let's talk a little bit about the time travel element. Everyone who writes a time travel story has to invent a mechanism to carry it out. And there's probably as many devices for time travel as there are books about it. And you have an interesting scheme where you have something called an anomaly, You have incumbents, and you have, and I'll have to get make sure that you explain the concept behind a chronometrist. I don't even know if I'm saying that right.
Chronometrist. However you like.
Can you just describe how you came up with the concept of these elements and how they play out, generally speaking, in the book?
Yeah, like what is the anomaly? Maybe start with that.
The anomaly is essentially the portal through which Hallie travels to different time periods, but it's a sort of more of an organic kind of being rather than a sort of technological fix, which is something I was keen to do because, as you say, there are so many different time travel mechanisms out there, and I was trying to think about something a little different. So it's kind of sentient, but not in a way that humans experience sentience. It could be alien. It might not be alien. It might be native to Earth. So I wanted there to be a little bit of ambiguity there with, you know, where this thing actually came from. But in the way the travel works, each anomaly has one single incumbent, which is the traveler that kind of responds to it. So in this case, Hallie is the incumbent for the anomaly in Paris. But in terms of kind of where I was... where I had the inspiration from, it was kind of thinking about symbiosis and nature, which is something I've always been intrigued by. And obviously there's loads of different kinds of symbiosis. There's sort of mutually beneficial kinds, but there's also these quite parasitic and sort of sinister types of symbiosis, like the cockroach wasp is the example I use in the book, which is a kind of wasp that stings the cockroach and then uses it as a host for its larvae. So it essentially sort of hollows it out from the inside. So I also wanted there to be this element with the anomaly where it was both a kind of an enabler for Hallie, but it's also kind of the antagonist of the book in a way, because it's the more you travel, the idea is the anomaly kind of gets hold of you and eventually you kind of become this disembodied being, which is what the chronometrist has become. She was one of the original travelers. And she's sort of traveled so many times that essentially it's kind of eroded her physical being. And she's now this kind of disembodied thing tied to the time stream who doesn't have any physical presence in the real world. So that's the kind of danger for Hallie, is if she keeps traveling and keeps traveling and keeps traveling, that is what she could become.
And so during your answer, Rob himself went through an amazing arc where he wrote down a little note to me that said, "I want to be an incumbent." But then he heard about the wasp, and then he heard about the thing about losing yourself, and I think he probably is now no longer interested in being an incumbent.
I read the book, so I do know that happens, but it's easy to forget in the beginning how much fun it seems to be an incumbent who finds your anomaly and gets to travel through time, and you forget about the chronometrist, where you're a disembodied spirit who floats in and out of birds and strangers on the street, which is what she basically does in order to communicate with Hallie.
That's the end game. So it comes at a big cost, but certainly you could have some fun for a while, I think.
And I kind of like the chronometrist, although I guess she isn't always kind to the people who she hosts.
You're very forgiving,
Rob. But I mean, I thought she was a humorous character, except when she ended up killing a few people along the way, but very almost incidentally to her. She didn't seem to care very much about that.
I enjoyed writing her. I quite liked her. Yeah, she does have quite a warped view of life, I think. But then I imagine becoming disembodied would do that to you.
Even though Hallie is traveling through time, there are a number of things that are constant, like the bar, Millie's in Montmartre, where the anomaly is, and there's Paris, which is famous around the world for its unchanging quality, you know, maybe because it survived World War II intact.
I mean, one of the things I love about Paris is it does have this incredible history. I mean, as any city does, really, but, you know, at times quite tumultuous history. And there's so many different fascinating time periods that you could go to and explore. And there were some I had to kind of stay away from because they'd already been done elsewhere so well already. But I think also it's kind of perhaps the allure of the kind of constant element of it was this sort of sense of Paris as a kind of cultural hub, I guess. You know, obviously the French are very, very proud of their culture and really protect their culture. And I think Paris often has this kind of, I guess, reputation as a kind of center for for that exchange of ideas. I'm thinking about periods like the Enlightenment, like all the writers and artists that were sort of drawn there in the 1920s. And I guess that kind of gave me the idea of as a sort of potential hub for new conversations, new ideas, new movements, like the sort of political movements that in the book that started by Ada Lafour, The New Bohemia. So perhaps it was that sense of constancy in terms of being a sort of portal for communication in a way that drew me to it, I think, as much as its history, because its history is actually, you know, pretty violent at times and very changeable. And yet the city itself does retain this very strong sense of place that, you know, is throughout literature and film and books and so many different aspects of culture.
And I suppose it makes it easier for Hallie. She knows where things are, even as she travels over the course of a century.
Yeah.
She makes these observations about things that have, in fact, stayed the same.
And I think, you know, Paris is quite small as well as a city, so it is quite easy to navigate in that sense.
You know, you talked a little bit about how your experience working at a bar yourself inspired some of this book. And in our introduction, Rob and I were discussing how much we liked how strong the character development in the book was and the world building, not science fiction world building, but the building of this social network. And what we remarked on in the intro was that sometimes in science fiction novels, the characters are just a vehicle for the plot. But in some parts of the book, it felt like the reverse, that the kind of the character development and the relationships between the people were more important for stretches of the book than just plot service. And so I just wonder, I mean, A, you can tell me if that was part of your point, but B, I guess it makes me think about science fiction and maybe the process of writing science fiction, if writers should be thinking about character development differently. And if you have any role models that you think do that well, that are able to service plot, but at the same time are drawing out really strong characters. I know that's a lot of questions all at once, but...
I mean, I guess I don't feel that there should be a difference in how science fiction writers approach character to any other writer. But then I've never really thought about my own writing in terms of writing in a particular genre. You know, I love science fiction because it has so many endless possibilities and it's the biggest canvas available to you as a writer. So for me, I think character kind of comes first, regardless of what type of genre I'm writing in. But certainly, I guess my personal taste in writing is, you know, I'm most interested in works that do have a sort of strong sense of character, that are interested in using different forms, different styles, you know, where the writing is strong. And I'm also interested in works that kind of push at the edges of those quite regulated categories. So a lot of the writers that I really love kind of are in that kind of borderline area, I guess. So writers like David Mitchell, like Haruki Murakami, are sort of some of my, you know, my oldest heroes in writing. But more recently, I'm trying to think of some good examples. I mean, one book that I thought was superb was Speak by Louisa Hall, which kind of had four or five different voices, and it explores issues around artificial intelligence. Everything from Alan Turing to a sort of, you know, self-aware artificial intelligence in the future. And that's a sort of beautiful example, I think, of mixing, you know, science fiction and characterization. Another example, I also love Sarah Hall, who is published as a mainstream writer, but her novel, The Carhollan Army, is very much a kind of dystopia. And again, the characterization and the writing in that is just beautiful. So I think there's a lot of examples from, you know, from both in science fiction and in mainstream that do both those things.
But getting back to the plot for a moment, one of the challenges about the time travel genre, I think, is that it's obviously a resonant genre because many books are written in using this mechanism. People are interested in this idea of redoing history and changing one thing and what happens. But the range of outcomes is a little limited, and it's not really a hard science kind of topic. Like, you go back in the past, you change something, and we all know lots of things react as a result. But beyond saying that, there's not much more that you can do. And I guess I think of it as sort of a challenge for a writer. I mean, I was even thinking about a very popular book like Stephen King's 11-22-63, which is all about basically saving Kennedy from being assassinated. And you have 800 pages of novel, and then basically, spoiler alert, he realizes that what he did leads to nuclear holocaust, so he has to do a do-over. And so you think, like, oh gosh, all this time spent on time travel, and he really was kind of stupid. He shouldn't have done it in the first place. And so I don't know. I guess I just wonder how you write around it. It's a very attractive genre. People love time travel books, but where you can take it is a little limited.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think once you start thinking about the kind of logistics of it, it is quite overwhelming and quite terrifying to think about how you're going to get the plot to work. And certainly, I did a lot of work in the editing process for it to try and pull that together. I guess one of the ways I kind of looked at that was by the idea that the book starts in the future, and the whole frame for the novel is that you start in the future with the intention that the past has to be changed, but you don't ever actually go back to that future in the rest of novel. Yeah, it is a tricky one. I guess I wasn't thinking too much about the technicalities of it because, as you say, I was more interested in the character and the impact of that time travel, you know, what that does to you as a person and what that means for Hallie and her kind of character development. And that was definitely, that was the driving force for me rather than the focus being on the plot, I suppose.
Let me just say that I think I disagree a little bit with Aubrey in that I think, you know, time travel books open up a whole world of possibilities. Of course, I guess...
Free is patent pending.
Yeah. Okay. They open up a universe of potential. No, I mean, of course, okay, you do one thing and it's going to change things, but it's fascinating to think about the things you could change or not. Anyway, I think that there's a lot of good storytelling that could be done around it, which is exactly what you do. So maybe as a follow-up, let me ask a little bit about the different historical dilemmas and situations that Hallie finds herself in as she's traveling through time. She's basically on a mission, which she herself doesn't fully understand until later in the book, to prevent a future apocalypse by, in fact, changing history. And I think one of the messages that comes through is that through small changes, through small gestures, really, you can have a big impact because without giving too much away, I think one of her first assignments is to prevent the construction of the famous church, Sacré-Cœur, which she turns into, through really a few brief conversations, a green windmill, which becomes a new icon of Paris.
She's sort of an architectural muse.
Yes, I did want there to be, you know, that sort of sense of this, you know, that small actions can make a big difference. And I think one of the fun things in kind of thinking about how the time travel works was, okay, so she's, you know, she's got this mission that she doesn't fully understand. She needs to convince the architect to change his idea for the Sacré-Cœur into something very different. She has no idea quite what's going to come out of it. But then I had fun with that, playing then with the repercussions of the green windmill and what that symbolizes then in the present. So that was a kind of, that was an interesting way to pull the kind of politics of the present day on board. And as you say, a sort of minor conversation could actually have kind of ripples that were quite profound in the present.
Everywhere she goes, I mean, every time period she goes, apocalypse always feels right around the corner, virtually. I mean, she ends up shortly after the French Revolution, which must have felt and was, in fact, very apocalyptic to French society and the people who lived through it. And then she ends up in the middle of the Nazi occupation of Paris, which is another horrific time.
Yeah.
And then we go into the future and we see a world in which Le Pen is an icon that people admire and has taken control of part of Paris and part of France. And I just got the feeling that you were reminding readers that we're always on the brink, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that's definitely something I wanted to kind of convey. And I think, you know, that sense of how quickly we forget as well, you know, all these kind of sort of endless conflicts. And there's a sort of point in the book where Hallie's kind of reflecting on that in the the World War II section. And it, you know, at times it does just feel like there's one thing after another after another. And, you know, when will we ever learn? And I think the book did definitely take that message on more strongly in response to kind of the, you know, current events and current politics and, you know, the kind of disturbing rise of the nationalistic right that we're seeing, the sort of extreme polarization of opinion and populism. And I guess I just felt like I needed to engage with that, that, you know, if I was writing about these periods in the past, that you can't really not engage with that in the present as well. So I think that message became stronger during the process of writing.
Even this becomes more complicated in the context of the book, because essentially the people in the future who set all this in motion basically are creating a crisis to save a worst apocalypse. So
yeah.
There's a kind of trade-off inherent in that. That you, for Haley, the crisis that's set in motion to save apocalypse creates for her a personal apocalypse, but for the people in the future, it is a better result for them.
Yeah, they're kind of playing, I guess, the long game there, but there's always a price for it.
Well, I just hope, you know, when we, Aubrey and I last did a podcast together, we interviewed Dave Hutchinson, who like you, is also published by Solaris.
Yeah.
But we interviewed him on the eve of Brexit.
Literally the night before.
Literally the night before. And it was a monumental moment. So I hope now that we're talking about, you know, Le Pen and nationalism, this is not a foreboding of...
We may be the anomaly.
Oh, right. Oh, my God. Well, yeah. Hopefully...
Is something happening tomorrow that we don't know about? Anyway, yeah. Okay, so...
Well,
right.
there was a worrying moment when I was, I think the book had pretty much been written and edited and signed off and the French elections were coming up and I was thinking, oh God, I really, really hope Le Pen doesn't get in. For many reasons.
Right.
But yeah, I think, you know, that again is something when you're writing something like this that is set very much in the sort of present day, there's always the danger that things will have changed completely by the time the book actually gets out in the world.
For the record, Dave Hutchinson was horrified at the idea that Brexit would actually happen. So even though it served to show the relevance of his plot. And so how did the book do? How are you feeling about that?
And we should note it's only been out a couple months.
It's hard to know kind of at this early stage, you know, how it's doing in terms of sort of commercially, I guess. But I mean, I'm already writing, working on the new book. I have, because there's always quite long lead-in times for publishing anyway, you've usually kind of, I'm normally stuck into something else by the time the book comes out, so.
Can you tell us anything about the new book?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So I'm kind of going back to my interest in climate change and the natural world. And this novel I'm working on at the moment is particularly inspired by coral reefs and the Great Barrier Reef in particular in Australia and the recent bleaching crisis, which has affected coral reefs all around the world, as a result of climate change. So it's kind of following three women across three different centuries, past, present and future. And they're linked by a love of the ocean. So it's very much kind of engaging with the natural world and biodiversity and kind of the impact of industrialization on the environment and all those kind of issues. But there's definitely no time travel in this one because I think I've done enough of that.
This may be too general a question, but I wonder if European science fiction writers, you think, perhaps have different concerns or interests than American ones, if you have any thoughts on that or any observations.
It's a difficult one because I don't know if I'm widely read enough to really be able to answer that. And certainly, I mean, obviously, we don't have a huge amount in translation as well that's accessible. You know, I'd love to read more non-British European science fiction in translations. I think that might give quite a different picture. I don't know. I mean, I guess the main trends I see that, you know, I've kind of noticed tend to be across both, which is the one on the sort of continuing interest in the post-apocalyptic. And then on the other side, there seems to be quite a movement towards more hopeful, more optimistic narratives. But I think I see that in both British and American SF. So I'm not sure on that one.
This was great. And the book is terrific, as we've said. So congratulations.
Thank you. No, I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Emma.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So we've been talking to EJ Swift, the author of Paris Adrift, which came out in February 2018 from Solaris.
For more author interviews, check out newbooksnetwork.com and click on the Science Fiction Show link, or subscribe to the New Books in Science Fiction podcast on your favorite podcasting app.
And I just want to point out, Rob, that we managed to get the phrase tilting at green windmills in the interview itself very naturally. That was the challenge we set out for us at the beginning of this interview. So yes. Thanks, Emma.
Yes.
You're very welcome.
Our theme music is by Michael Aaron of QuiverNYC.com. The editor-in-chief of the New Books Network is Marshall Poe, and the editor is Leanne Wilson. Please, please consider leaving a review if you liked what you heard today. I'm Rob Wolf, and today I'm with
Aubrey Fox.
Wolf and Fox, those are names you will never forget. And listeners, we couldn't do this without you, so thank you.